The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. The first article that I have for you today is submitted by Damon Cable, and it's titled Bridge Fishing. I grew up in a small community called Elport, which is part of Elwood City in northwestern Pennsylvania. Elport is surrounded on three sides by the Conocunesing Creek, named by the Lenape Indians of the area. Conocunesing means for a long way straight. My parents' house was close to the banks of the Conocunesing, and a short distance upstream was the mouth of Slippery Rock Creek, where it emptied into the Conocunesing. A bridge we called First Bridge spanned the Conocunesing. There was also a second bridge and a third bridge. These crossed Slippery Rock Creek. All three bridges were fairly close together. My cousin John lived on a hill overlooking the second bridge and Slippery Rock Creek. The second bridge was a favorite place for John and me to play. Of course, our parents didn't know this. John and I would fish from the second bridge. That's not quite true. I should say we tried to fish from the bridge. We would walk to the bridge, and when no cars were coming, we would run to the midpoint of the bridge and climb over the side. Just a short climb down would bring us to a small ladder. This ladder went down to the top of the huge stone and concrete pillar, or piling, that held up the middle of the bridge. This was a great hidey hole and play area. There was lots of room on top of that stone pillar. It was a wide, smooth surface. Underneath the bridge roadway, we would play and try to fish. Cars zoomed across the bridge right over our heads. We would sit and dangle our legs over the side of the pillar and drop our fishing lines in the water. The pillar was sunk into the middle of the creek bed. Every time we looked down into the water, we could see huge schools of suckers lazily swimming around the base of the pillar. We tried many times to catch one, but they just wouldn't bite. We tried using dough balls, which was water and flour mixed and thickened with molasses. Worms and soft-shelled crabs, the fish never took the bait. One day I brought along a very large treble hook. I thought I was sure to get a fish with that. It didn't work either. No matter how fast or slow I pulled up on the line, it never snagged the fish. They just swam away. John's mother, my Aunt Mildred, always fixed us lunches with drinks to take along when we went out to play. It was usually a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, one of my favorites, chocolate chip cookies, and an apple. We also brought along water in canteens that we strapped onto our belts. There was no such thing as bottled water back then. We filled the canteens from the garden hose. Since the suckers wouldn't bite on anything and we couldn't snag them with the treble hook, we thought maybe we could bomb them from above. We both climbed the ladder and waited on the side of the bridge until no cars were coming. We didn't want anyone to see us and tell our parents what we were up to. When it was safe, we climbed up the rest of the way and ran quickly to one end of the bridge. Along the roadside, we found many rocks and stones. We filled all our pockets with rocks as large as was fit. Then we stood by the road and waited again for a pause in the traffic. When no cars were going by, we ran quickly to the middle of the bridge and climbed over the side again. The suckers were still there. We both held a large rock in each hand and sighted up over the biggest sucker we could see. On the count of three, we shouted, "Bombs away!" and released the rocks. There were four big splashes, and the fish all swam away. The rocks quickly sank to the bottom. We were disappointed that the rock bombs didn't work either. The fish returned shortly after. We never did catch any fish from the bridge. None of our parents knew we climbed down the side of the bridge and played on top of the pillar. It was a fun spot for us, where there was no one to tell us what to do or tattle on us to our parents. Fortunately, fishing wasn't the only reason to go there. We would sit and talk and play, in addition to trying to catch fish. We could spend the entire afternoon under that bridge. We talked about school and our friends and our families. How fun it was to be 12. The next story I have for you is titled, A Reversed Route to Victory, and this is submitted by Joe Palermo. In the summer of 1968, we packed up our family station wagon to make our annual trek from the Chicago suburbs to the Small Bones Maplewood Resort in Sister Lakes, Michigan. Though it was a drive of only 2.5 hours, our cries of, "Are we there yet?" were still heard. The resort was owned by George Smallbone. His last name always made me laugh, as he was a former college football star who stood about 7 feet tall and weighed over 300 pounds. Consisting of more than 30 cabins, the resort had been built by his grandfather, and George had grown up there. He was a jovial man and loved interacting with the guests as he roamed around. Families rented individual cabins, but meals were eaten collectively. Each day at mealtime, a large bell outside the dining hall was rung so that everyone knew it was time to eat. All would gather in the large dining room. Tables were arranged randomly with multiple families at each table, so it was always a surprise to see who your meal mates were. It was a set menu, but the meals would differ each day and were always more than enough. We kids were excited to drink iced tea instead of the milk we always had at home. The resort had a sandy beach on a lake with a pier that went out onto the water. As a kid, I spent a lot of time swimming and playing in the sand. My favorite place, though, was the rec room. It featured a pop machine where the bottles could be pulled out cold, and I could enjoy my favorite grape or orange crush. There was also a machine with warm cashews for 5 cents. I can taste them now just thinking about it. Several pinball machines stood against the wall and kept me begging my parents for dimes and quarters. It was one game for a dime and 3 for a quarter. Luckily, my mother also enjoyed pinball, so she was an easy target. In the center of the room was a ping pong table. Music from a jukebox played constantly, and we often heard the Beatles singing Hey Jude or Creedence Clearwater Revival belting out Susie Q. We could also play shuffleboard, which we sometimes enjoyed as a family, with my sister and me challenging our parents. The highlight of the week for us kids were the outdoor races featuring a variety of sack races, wheelbarrow races, walking with a potato on a spoon, and others. I preferred the traditional running races. The events were usually divided into age groups, and when each was over, all the participants went to the prize table, which was a sight to behold. It was a large rectangle filled with what seemed like countless toys. There were toy bow and arrows, squirt guns, yo-yos, and too many others to mention. Regardless of how they performed in the race, each kid could select one toy, though the winner always chose first. My standout moment came during a running race. I lined up at the starting line late, but I resolved that I would win that race no matter what, and focused my gaze hard on the finish line to the exclusion of all else. The starter gun sounded, and I took off like a shot, running as fast as I could. I was all alone and saw no one else around me. I put my head down and gave it everything I had. To my surprise, I was the first one over the line and began jumping up and down with excitement, trying to make sure my parents had been watching. Not only were they watching, but my father was filming it on his movie camera. Everyone else on the sidelines was also staring at me, and all were laughing. It turns out I had missed the race instructions stating it would be a reverse race to be run in the opposite direction. I had run the wrong way. My face was now red as a beet, and it was all on camera. I slunk over to the table and claimed my prize. Though I laughed along with everyone else, I knew this would not be a quickly forgotten moment. True to form, my parents and sister still remind me of that day more than 50 years later. We know how to keep each other humble. It's been years now since the resort was dismantled and replaced by waterfront condos. Our trip in that station wagon each year is still etched in my mind. I would run 100 races in the wrong direction if it would bring those days back. Instead, I'm content to savor the memories. The next story I have for you is titled Dad's Garden, and this is submitted by Linda Doty. I remember the summer of 1958 in my hometown of Closter, New Jersey, when the air smelled of newly mowed grass and the days were long and sunny. Most all our neighbors had vegetable gardens in the summer. I was just 8 years old, and like all those wonderful gardens, it was a good time to be growing. The best time was when Dad was in the garden. Dad had a big vegetable garden that he took much pride in. Loved by the sun, he was fit and tan. During the hot summer, he didn't wear a shirt, only a pair of khaki pants and an old straw hat. From turning over the soil in the spring and then fertilizing it with fresh horse manure delivered by the owner of a nearby horse farm, to planting the seeds and harvesting thyme, he loved his garden and worked hard in it. When the season was ripe, Dad's garden rewarded us with a bounty of fresh vegetables that made summer meals delicious. Dad's tomatoes were the best. There was nothing better than a tomato fresh from Dad's garden, sliced and layered on bread with mayo and salt and pepper on a hot summer day. Dad would have my brother Fred and me help weed the garden. We didn't mind. It made us feel we were part of the garden's glory. Fred and I would do the weeding in the early morning before the heat set in, or late in the day when the sun was going down. When August rolled around, we had more tomatoes than our family could eat. Fred and I set up a little stand made from an old crate at the edge of our property near the main road. Our bright red shiny tomatoes filled a bushel basket next to our stand. We made a sign out of poster paper, "Jersey tomatoes for sale cheap." And passers-by, seeing the sign and how reasonable our prices were, would stop and buy. We would carefully wrap the tomatoes in old newspaper, and our customers would happily take them home, knowing how sweet and yummy they were going to taste in a salad. That summer of 1958, my mother and aunt convinced my dad to enter the Garden Club yearly contest. He entered the biggest cucumber from his garden, and to his surprise and great joy, he won the blue ribbon prize. Dad's cucumbers, fresh from the garden, sliced and sprinkled with salt, made a yummy summer snack. Dad's squash was also a summer favorite. He would slice them and fry them in a batter of egg and flour. Digging up radishes and potatoes was like discovering treasure. Fresh from the garden and well washed, they were ready to be prepared for a lunch or dinner. Watching Dad in the garden every summer gave me a great sense of peace, and it made me love the land. The very best of Dad was in the garden. When I look back on my childhood now, I'm grateful for that special time when Dad was in the garden. Here's a little flashback fun for you. The Jolly Green Giant made his first appearance in TV commercials for Green Giant canned vegetables in 1954. His booming "ho, ho, ho" was added to the company's jingle in 1961 when Green Giant introduced their frozen vegetable line. Katie Westvere submits our next story, which is titled, A Saturday in Marked Tree. The year was 1943, and Josie Young and her brother Pete were staying with their Aunt Van and Uncle Charlie in Marked Tree, Arkansas, while picking cotton. Josie was 15 and usually lived up in the hills near Charlotte with her family. One Saturday morning, she got up, washed her hair, and put on her new green pantsuit. She was going to town. That is what people did in the South on Saturdays. They went to town. Marked Tree was a place to be on Saturdays. 16-year-old Aubrey Holt, or AC as everyone called him, was also in town that day, hanging around with a bunch of boys at the pool hall. He was standing outside the pool hall when Josie and her cousin, Weona, came across the railroad tracks at the top of the hill. He knew Weona from around town, but he had never met Josie before. He called out at Weona, and soon the group of them were talking. Josie and Weona were on their way to the corner cafe, and AC said he would meet them there. As soon as Josie and Weona left, AC went to look up his dad to get some money, and soon he joined them at the cafe. To Josie's surprise, he sat down in the booth next to her, not Weona. They met again that night at the movies. Of course, AC showed up after the girls were already seated. It was a good thing because he only had enough money for his own ticket. Josie was only in Marked Tree for about 4 weeks until the cotton picking was done. Then she went back to her folks' place up in the hills. But during those 4 weeks, a relationship had started between the two, and they wondered if they would ever see each other again. As fate would have it, Josie's parents moved to Marked Tree the following year, so Josie and AC got to see each other again. But when school started up in the fall, Josie went back to the hills to live with her Uncle Sam so she could graduate from the high school there. She was the first of the young children to do so. After graduating from high school, Josie and Weona headed to Kansas City, where they both found work. AC joined the Merchant Marine and shipped out of New Orleans. He wrote to Josie once while he was away. She still has that letter today. When AC got back home, he found out that Josie was now living in Memphis with another friend, Rebecca, and working as a telephone operator. But she took the bus home every weekend because she was homesick for her family. During one of those weekends, Josie and AC went to the movies, and afterward, AC walked her home. While sitting on the front porch of her family's home, AC said, "Don't go back to Memphis tomorrow." Those six words were all it took. AC and Josie became engaged. The next morning, Sunday, Josie told her family that she and AC were going to get married that day. Her older brother, Buck, was the only one to show any emotion. He paced the kitchen floor all morning long. Later that day, AC walked to Josie's house, and together they began the long walk to town. When they were near the town limits, AC hired a cab to take them the rest of the way to the Justice of the Peace. It was a good thing because that cab driver became the witness they needed for their marriage license. They had no family with them when they got married, just the two of them. That evening, they went to the movies, and afterward, they walked to AC's parents' house, where they spent their wedding night. The next morning, AC went off to work, and Josie tried to get to know her new mother-in-law. Then she got word that her own mother was sick, and she was needed at home to take care of the family. When AC came back from work that night, his new bride had already gone. He walked across the fields to Josie's parents' house, and they stayed there for about a week until her mother was well enough to look after the family again. When they left, they went to a little house that AC had found near his parents, and that was where they started their married life and were blessed to be able to celebrate 60 years of marriage. The next story I want to share with you is titled Lightning Bugs for a Nightlight, and this was submitted by Sarah Etchen Baker. When I was a little girl, Granddad and I spent many summer evenings together, sipping lemonade and swinging back and forth on his vintage metal porch glider. On one such evening, as I sat with him, we watched the sun sink lower in the Missouri sky. The trees gradually became silhouettes against a newly silver sky. Together, we silently watched their branches sway in the wind. Soon it grew dark, and the first sound of the nighttime creatures came, chirping crickets and buzzing mosquitoes. Then, out of nowhere, a mysterious yellow twinkling appeared in the night, quick flickers and crackles of incandescent light almost too fast for the naked eye. The soft, warm glow of the lightning bugs sliced through the darkness, dipping beneath the black walnut trees. I was enchanted and imagined Granddad and I had discovered the lair of a great magician. "Want to catch some lightning bugs?" Granddad asked, a smile spreading over his face. "Capture that magic?" My voice quivered with excitement. "Can it be done?" "Yes," he said, practically leaping out of the swing to fetch a mason jar from his work shed. Using an ice pick, he pierced its lid with tiny holes. He took my hand in his, and together we walked barefoot into the darkness, following the flickering light. I let go of his hand and ran toward them, hoping to capture them, but in my eagerness, they escaped. Granddad cupped his hands and lunged. "Look," he said, making a peephole into his hand. With my face pressed against his thumbs, I caught my first close-up glimpse of a firefly. The jar soon grew full. When Granddad tucked me in that night, he placed it beside my bed. The glow of the lightning bugs mesmerized me, and long after everyone else was asleep, I was still wide awake, watching the golden lights flare in the darkness. Now, so many years later, I've forgotten most of the dolls and toys of my childhood, but the night Granddad and I caught lightning bugs and made them into a nightlight is forever imprinted in me. There was so much ordinary magic dancing around Granddad's backyard. And our next article is written by Mark Madison, and it's titled Threshing Time. I grew up on a dairy farm in the Blue Hills of northern Wisconsin. In the 1950s, our farm was typical of the farms in our area. We milked about a dozen Holstein cows and farmed 120 acres of land. Much of our land was in pasture and woodlots. The crops we planted were oats and corn. We had good equipment for working our fields, but certainly not new equipment and not the latest labor-saving models. Each August, we'd harvest our oats. Dad would cut the oats with a binder. The binder would leave rows of oat bundles in the field. This is where I would get involved. My job was to stack the bundles into shocks for the threshing crew. I would stand several bundles upright, leaning them together in a circle. One or two bundles were placed on top for a cap to withstand the rain. I remember having a hard time making shocks that wouldn't fall over. That's not too surprising for a 7 or 8 year old boy. A few days later, after I had placed the oats in shocks, the threshing crew came. This was a day of great excitement. The threshing machine was enormous and operated with a long belt attached to a tractor's pulley. The shocks were brought in from the field and were run through the thresher, which separated the oat kernels from the stems, or straw. The straw was blown into a large pile to be used for winter bedding. The oats were bagged in gunny sacks and taken to the granary. I was allowed to help hold the sacks while they were being filled with oats. The bag of oats were taken to the Buchholz feed store where they were ground with corn as needed. Mom had the biggest job during threshing. She had to prepare meals for the crew. Sometimes she would have the help of a neighbor, but other times it was all her responsibility. One year, Dad wanted to show off our collie dog's herding ability to the crew. Besides being a family pet, a cow dog had two basic responsibilities. After a cow was milked, she was released from her stanchion to go back outside. Many of the cows walked directly outside. However, some would hang back, and that's where Shep came in. He would nip at their heels and hurry them outside. The second job was to help herd the cattle into the barn from the pasture. Our pasture was half a mile long and a quarter mile wide. With all the brush and woodland spots, it could be tough to find the cows. Shep went above and beyond what was expected of a cow dog. He could be sent on his own to find and bring in the herd. I remember Dad telling me that he was going to show the threshing crew just what Shep could do. In the late afternoon, when all the fellows were gathered, Dad called Shep. "Shep, go get the cows," Dad said, and Shep took off. The men went back to work. About 45 minutes later, here came the herd with Shep gently directing them. The men were very impressed. I don't think I ever saw my dad so filled with pride as he was for Shep that day. In the early 1960s, we purchased a combine with our neighbor Jen's. Dad also put up a steel grain bin and purchased a gravity box for the oats to be transported to the grain bin. Using the combine to harvest our oats was much more efficient than threshing, but it was not as much fun for a boy. To close out today's program, here are things my parents used to say. Growing up, Dorothy Costine Sawyer of Lakeland, Florida, remembers that her family always had fresh milk and cream from the family's cow that her mom milked. After she started drinking coffee, Dorothy would always add a lot of fresh cream, but her mother would warn her not to stir it with a fork or the cow will kick. As a kid, when Richard Connard of Windsor, Colorado, turned up his nose at something his mother made for dinner, his father would remark, "Even if it was good, you wouldn't like it." Henry David Thoreau said, "Many men go fishing all of their lives without knowing that it is not the fish they are after." We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it, and I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And that number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.